would like to talk about eyes and heat and the sea of light. And I have a couple of weird and disturbing stories, but not like true in the sense of a newspaper. Many layers of meaning and many centuries of telling. So once upon a time, no one knows how long ago, in India, there was a man named Kapil who was meditating a lot in a cave. And as you might have already felt today with your meditation, welcome, that even in resting, which is what Kapil was doing, though he was in a damp cave and sitting upright, according to the stories, even when resting, there's something that is allowed to go against the stream. So if we just consider what even resting is and what's possible during rest that isn't possible when we're awake. And when things go against the stream, they go against the habit energies, they go against the conditioning, they go against predictability, there's a kind of friction. So even though it's going against a stream, there's a friction. And so meditation is sometimes called tapas, which means heat. And it's the same root as our word for temperature or thermometer, therm. So Kapil was hot, as you could say. And it might not be such a different meaning from what we have today when we would say, well, Kapil is hot. Because there's also some connection that we wouldn't like to notice, usually. We don't know what to do with, it's disturbing. When we find out that as meditation and rest allows something that's very alive to go against the stream of containment and conditioning and past, there's a kind of erotic dimension that appears. And that goes so against our expectation of being alone and quiet and still and free that it's hard to know what comes next. If it's possible to let that erotic energy arise and still have the option of being calm and still and alive and free with it, and not letting it either kind of just close down onto one person or just go into the back pocket or even farther away from the genitals in the closet somewhere. It gives even more kind of power to the furnace of practice. And that doesn't just burn away what's unnecessary and unfruitful or dead. It also kind of melts and warms up what's alive. It incubates. So Kapil was there in the cave meditating. And he wasn't that aware when a white horse came wandering into the cave, seemingly by accident, and just stayed there in the cave. Strange that a horse would go into a cave and stay there. But there wasn't much grass to eat or anything. The horse had never really tried mushrooms before. And not too many days later, 60,000 boys and men came in and said, "Ah, I see the horse. Let's kill him. He stole the horse." And those voices disturbed Kapil's meditation, whereas the horse had not. And Kapil's eyes opened, and before he could stop it, the force of his practice came out through his eyes and burned the 60,000 to ashes. So what's going on here? If we go back to once upon a time, long ago in India, while Kapil was meditating, someone else was doing another kind of practice that also gathers energy. He was doing a kind of esoteric ritual, but for his profit. So there was a lot of different esoteric sciences at the time in India that some people still carry on. We might call it sort of magic. So this would be more along the lines of a black magic, but it was a fire ceremony that could be done. It's called the Ashwamedh sacrifice. And so there's a lot of resources that get involved and a lot of chanting and a lot of organization. And the idea is that when the sacrifice is finished, when the ceremony is done, a white horse is set free, and whatever country that horse sets foot into comes to be the property of the one who organized the sacrifice, the ceremony. So the reason to put all of that energy and all of those resources into this ceremony is so that you can have more countries. So I told you it was a weird and disturbing story. We're not finished yet. Who were the 60,000 boys and men? And what happens next? But just stop, pause. If we can just take into account that the story maybe never actually happened, maybe it did, but it is happening. So there is that part of us that wants territory and would like to have as much as possible and would put all of our resources into some, any kind of ceremony that could get us some territory. And there's some part of us that's just quiet and away and hidden in a cave. So the man who did the sacrifice had apparently 60,000 sons. So that part of us that wants territory has a lot of offspring. And so it would be good to be aware how we train our offspring. So these children, these sons, were told to go find what had happened to the white horse. Where had it gone? How many countries had we won? Why hadn't it come back? Who was playing funny tricks with us? We were playing by the rules. So I just want to again pause and just feel that it's disturbing. It's disturbing to be in touch with the force of greed. And if we can stay still and calm and feel where that comes from in us, in you, a wanting of territory and more territory and a willingness to send like your innocence out in search of what's gone wrong, where's my territory, why hasn't it kind of come to completion? Why is there an open-endedness? Why is there not a finality to getting what I want? And the willingness of that innocence to go out and look for the white horse out of some kind of loyalty. So loyalty, in this case, in the story, to the father and to the kind of expectations of how things should go and what's rightfully ours, kind of. So innocence, being willing to lose innocence, to follow the rules and get what was expected. And just feeling for where there could be another way that the story goes, another ending. Innocence that loves to be innocent and is even willing to be disloyal. So for example, when there is sort of erotic energy with someone, for example, it's so easy to lose our innocence and our freedom in the sense, oh, we should just spend time with that person. Oh, and they'll be hurt if I don't. And then we've lost the innocence and we've lost even the erotic energy and what's going on. So just feeling for what we could be loyal to, kind of with innocence, without losing innocence, let's say. So the sons, feeling that they're very right, find the horse next to a man in a cave, and they just assume that this is the man who's disrupted the process of acquisition. And so they're planning what they're going to do to him. But it happens that he knows nothing about it. And it happens that there's a tremendous force that's built up in him, and he just opens his eyes. Most often in our lives, we feel that force as life events happening to us. We haven't spent the time and energy to kind of gather that together in us. But sometimes we can get a sense of what can happen with just the eyes and how much care could be involved in how we spend our sight, how we spend our eyes. And there's a great connection and a great part of the training in meditation with the eyes. So at first we spend a lot of time with our eyes closed so that we can calm and settle our system and find out what's happening. And then sometimes life will call upon you to be calm and settled and in touch with what's happening with your eyes open. So a kind of transparency. It's not only that the energy goes out. But a willingness to be seen and a willingness to see. And to find ways to let what you've come in touch with and the ways that you've gone against the stream and the power that that is to have gone against the stream and the power that that is to go against the stream of habits, conditioning, expectations, culture. Can you feel it's a power? Or does that sound still abstract? The fact that you're still here, you've gone against the stream. In the story, one version of the story, stories that were told a lot before they were written down have so many versions, but in one version, what's the connection between the horse and Kapil and the cave? Like, how did the horse end up in the cave? So interesting. So weird and so disturbing. In India, there are a lot of different beings that are recognized, so not just ones that we normally find ourselves seeing and talking to or looking at or talking about. And not just sort of one big God who exists or doesn't, but also, other than some kind of absolute or supreme something or other, there are the gods who are not supreme, who are not absolute, and also who are not human. So what is that in our experience? Something that doesn't quite have a body, that does have power, and in this story and in so many stories gets jealous of a human being who's accumulating power. In this case, God Indra, who is the king of gods, so there are kingdoms of gods. They have their relationships to each other. And Indra is considered to be, after a certain point in time, considered to be the most powerful. So that was called king. And King Indra gets jealous, not of Kapil this time, he does get jealous of meditators sometimes, but he gets jealous of the guy with the ceremony, getting all that territory. The horse was really wandering wide and far across a lot of state lines. And Indra thought, this can't be. We have to interrupt. And sent someone mischievous enough to guide the horse to Kapil's cave and disappear. I think I'd like to leave that question, what is that aspect of us, for now? To leave it open as a with a big smile on our face and a big sense of disturbance, like, what is that? With a sense of how that kind of God, the small g God, can be swayed, can be influenced, it can be appeased, can be kind of bought, we could say. And can be intimidated. And can be tricky. And for now, if we just take into account the need to not believe our conclusions and our assumptions. So when our innocence has gone in search of a white horse, when our innocence has gone on a mission, out of loyalty to a person or a cause or a thing, out of loyalty to some kind of greed, out of loyalty of some kind of sense of not enoughness, gotta get more, instead of loyalty to something more groundless and reliable than territory. When our innocence has gone out in search of something, with a sense of righteousness, maybe, being right, knowing what's right, knowing what's wrong. However proud we could be of ourselves for searching so thoroughly, like that possibility to search thoroughly could be neutral, could be used for something helpful. But when we can sense that it's being used for something closed, not open-ended, not open-hearted, we need, if we want to stay around, we do need to pause, and we do need to question our assumptions, even when something looks really obvious, like obviously Kapil took the horse to interrupt the righteous taking of land. And can't we get so caught up in that? Already you might have some territory in your meditation practice that you really want to kind of acquire. You want to occupy a certain territory. You want to be able to make your mind quiet for one full out-breath, maybe. And then you're going to tomorrow add the in-breath to that. Or for maybe you have more ambitions, like 45 minutes. Good luck. Even if you have 60,000 children helping you. Especially if you have 60,000 children trying to help you. And I'd just like to end that story and leave a lot of things hanging for now, but end the story with this, the question, the open question of how could that story go differently next time? Couldn't it go so differently in so many, on both sides, in the cave, in the kids, in the gods, in the king who wanted more? And maybe feeling for where your soft spot is, like if your soft spot might be as a father to the children, like as that part of you that loves what's innocent in you. Or what's innocent in you enjoying not having to grow up and get serious and have a job. Like, go find the horse. This is serious. If your soft spot is when you're feeling high, you're feeling happy, you're feeling cheerful, you're feeling light, but secretly competitive, maybe that's the soft spot, that it would be easy to just drop that competition and love the lightness and feel how that lightness is in its very nature expansive and generous. And I'd like for us to understand Kapil a little bit better. First, it's just to acknowledge that sometimes there is something going on. Nowadays, we kind of call it our inner process. There are knots that are getting unraveled. And from that, there's a kind of caustic juice that comes into our system that is really uncomfortable And sometimes we mistake that for, what's the word? The opposite of progress.
Progression?
Kind of, but that has the flavor of, like, psychology. So, going backwards, going away from where we want it to go. So just know that there will be days that you think you lost your track, and suddenly you feel really uncomfortable and angry, or suddenly whatever your sort of, what you consider your monsters to be are just all really awake and your awakeness seems to be missing. So again, to pause and not to assume anything, but to leave room for the possibility that maybe if you drink a lot of water and start as if from the beginning, rest again, it might just be flushing out the byproducts of letting go. So that's a real phenomenon. And even when we're drinking plenty of water and resting enough and having good conversations with people that are helpful for us and staying quiet a lot of the time, and letting the goodness of life really be absorbed inward. So this is another trick, in a good sense trick. So we also can be tricky, not to leave all the trickiness bag to go only to Indra. That's another helpful way that the story could go differently. As meditators, to adopt some trickiness. And so tricks like drinking lots of water and resting when you think what you need to do is really like tighten your belt and slap your back and come on, get quiet, get peaceful, grow up, and just do the opposite. Take the belt off, lie down, eat well, take a bath. Those are awesome tricks that we could take out of Indra's bag. But maybe the trickiest in the sense of most difficult to enact, and maybe also trickiest in the sense of godlike, small g, which could mean something like magical or having unexpected results in faraway places. And that is to first just open the door for some goodness in your life, in our lives. Simple, really, really simple goodness. Like in the pond, how the top part is warm and the bottom part is cool. It's good. Even if at first it's like, ooh, it's so warm. And then So the innocence comes back. And loves that simple goodness. The simple goodness of being alive and how aliveness talks to us in these simple ways. So that's like opening the door or opening the bag of tricks. But there's still the trick of soaking it inward. Because it does start to fill up. It does start to fill up in ways that do go against our stream, our habituated stream. Just being that full goes against our stream of lack. And being that full starts to dissolve and melt things, and things start to get out of place. And so it's just so simple as feeling joy, and then the tendency would be, I want to tell you about it. Or I want to show you. Or I want to write it down. Or I want to make up a song. Or I want to... And then this is what we call yogi mind. We people who are organizing retreats and hearing from you, hearing from each of you, as the energy starts to fill you up and things start to get out of place, you're going to have all these really great ideas about what you could do with all of that energy. So you might not be rested yet. I'm a little bit early. By tomorrow or the next day, you might be rested enough to start to feel. So I'll just give a couple of examples, simple ones, that just stayed with me over all these years. So there was one person who didn't and probably doesn't have a home of his own. And so there was not a home to redesign. So he went in his mind to his parents' home to redesign. So redesigning your parents' home if you don't have your own. That's one. And another one, just so, so sweet and so cute. If only we wouldn't follow through on them. Don't send that guy out. That son is too little to go make that really cool lamp, you know. Someone was having a retreat about lamps. They had all these great lamps in mind. And they were really, really great ideas, but not great lamps. So let the ideas pop and let it make you smile, and it would be just such a great idea. I'm sure your parents will agree with everything you have in mind. Including the lighting. Those were two different people, but they could make a company. The Sea of Light or whatever. So it's similar to staying with that, and it is actually staying with that erotic energy without going anywhere with it. It might go somewhere, and that's so, so sweet that you're attracted to someone in the room that you're not going to talk to this whole week. Don't talk to her or him. Just don't. Enjoy the feel of the energy and feel how and when it wants to go and what that's like. And it is so sweet, but just let it stay sweet instead of ridiculous. And so staying sweet, letting the innocent pop up with these funny things and enjoy that juice that sounds a lot like creativity, but don't let it enact those ideas just for a week. It's more important to stay in the juice and see how the juice cooks you and melts you and dissolves you. Even though it's unbearable, it can be unbearably good, unbearably sweet. And then we have the chance, so this is where Kapil's part of the story could go differently. Kapil's the guy in the cave, sitting upright. Getting the hang of that trick of enjoying the goodness, first of all. Oh yeah, it's not all bad. And really that starts to leave room for all these subtle kinds of goodness that we're not used to feeling. And then that gets to grow, that capacity to feel the subtle goodness. And then that gets so much, incredibly much more good than the examples that we could talk about easily. The subtle good is even more pleasurable. So even the Buddha, who I often call the poster child for suffering, and suffering as a kind of inspiration for awakening, even he talked about the physical pleasures and how the pleasures of meditation are, and let's say the godly pleasures. Let's go ahead and start to answer that question about what are these gods? The godly pleasures. I think he even gave a number to it, which I don't remember, but it was something like 38 times better. Let's say 36 sounds better. Times better than the worldly pleasures. And then there are the pleasures of freedom. So not not thinking that that's the end of the story, just where what now feels like sort of a butterfly wing, kind of subtle pleasure, when our capacity to feel that grows, that's even, whoa, even more unbearable. And there's still more, so not to be stuck there either, but to keep bearing the unbearable goodness. And we have good practice already as human beings with sexual energy, so as spiritual beings with sexual energy, as sexual beings with spiritual energy, as spiritual beings with sexual energy. It's very disturbing. We don't yet have a recipe. I don't know if there is one also, but there might be some recipes that we could come across in our experience if we can just find a way of staying with all of that together and not trying to close one book or the other, but leaving it open. It's blank right now, blank books. And we have that practice of when the sexual energy wants to go out, and okay, sometimes it just does. And sometimes we just even, it gets so complicated that we just need to let it go and have a great sexual fantasy and then come back. Okay, here's the breath, so what? That's possible, it's fine. But other times we can just come right back and just feel that. So similarly as other kinds of good happen, other kinds of eros, we'll call it. When we can find ways of practicing, diving into that, so immersion in that, then it seems to me we go so inward that there's not an outward anymore. So I think that we would hear the footsteps of the children coming. We would have already been in communication with the horse. We might have even found a way to get the horse out of the cave without disturbing the meditation. So even when life events seem to go against you impossibly, and it's not your fault that the horse is in your cave, you're just innocently meditating. But again, innocence as some kind of closed box of meditation, or innocence that goes so inward. Including also the violence that's built into the human being, including also the sexual energy, so that we're not surprised that someone is on the planet being violent somewhere, and we're connected. And we can hear maybe what's coming towards our cave and respond in a way that's even tricking what could be called gods. Are there questions or comments so far? Well, a few things, but just briefly, it feels an important detail. In the story, The boys and men who are the 60,000 sons are no longer in their innocence when they've come looking to kill someone for stealing a whore. They've already assumed wrong, and that can be helpful when we're feeling into the violence that's also part of human being. That first understanding how it often is that someone feels right and wronged and are coming from hurt and have no way of feeling how, when this is when violence is in action, how, no way of feeling the effects of their actions or words or non-actions, not words. Sometimes people know they're being violent and they're doing it on purpose, but a lot of times somewhere either hidden or very much all over the place, there's an unawareness of being violent. And so awareness of power, force, and how that gets directed is has an important place in human lives and especially spiritual practice. So we could feel in the children that when they're 60,000, I feel like it's hard to call them children. There must be a lot of like 80-year-old men there. But anyway, all ages. In the story, they're all males. So that maybe we can, that's another way the story could change in whatever way. But with the children, we can feel for the innocence, even though they're not acting in innocence. They're acting with a knowing that's false, that's incorrect. They're acting based on an assumption. But we could feel for their innocence. We can understand more easily, maybe, than the father who sent his sons out. Even the father we can understand. Okay. So there's another aspect that's very relevant for meditation that I've been working my way towards that I'm glad you're helping me get to. So I think the best way I can talk about it, Jamie, is from the Japanese art of Jinshin Jutsu that I've mentioned to some of you and some of you not. So it's just, this would be, you're doing Jinshin Jutsu even if you've never heard of it. It's that in us that has the confidence to feel for harmony and knows how to be in alignment with the harmony that's great enough to accommodate anything, including what we really, really find disturbing and don't want to accommodate. We don't want to be on the same planet with some people that we know about and some events. We don't want to be on the same planet, but we are. And there's something in us that has the confidence of, as life's child, to anyway, at least stay in alignment with life and then let life find whatever harmony could be that wide. And so I went like this. That doesn't make sense to you if you've never heard of it. Holding a finger or a thumb or wherever your hands already are in your body is one expression of that. I almost want to call it a drive. So a kind of movement that can come up in any part of us that can call upon also what is beyond us. So this is one gesture that they have where energy is coming through us, and that energy can help remind our poor little individual brain and heart and life, living lifestyle, body, all of it, from any of those doorways, to help us, to remind us to be ourselves more fully. And so letting the hand, letting the feet touch what they feel like touching can help that happen. And then one further understanding of, and again, it's interesting, I hadn't thought of this, but Jin Shin Jutsu literally means human being, God, spirit, or heart, tricks. So we're talking about the bag of tricks. That as a human being with a heart, spirit, God, whether you want a small or a big G or both, you can have it, because Japanese doesn't have capital letters. We're allowed to go into the bag of tricks before, during, and after any situation. Even when it's too late, we can go to the bag of tricks. And especially before it's needed. Okay. So there's this further understanding from the experience of being a person with a heart, spirit, God, and a bag of tricks available. That we're partly made of and made by what they call chi, so energy. It's not the most subtle energy. It's like life energy. It's like what makes the plants green, and it's what makes living creatures familiar to us, family to us. So chi, when chi comes into the body, which they consider to come into the body through the lower back, sacrum, so sacred part, comes in and it circulates through. And it can be that place where those ideas are popping in a state of innocence as the fullness and maybe the friction are melting and dissolving our assumptions, and which have limited us to a certain persona. The slightest assumption, when we're in the process of enjoying and absorbing the fullness of life, of our lives, we're in the process of letting chi also move through more freely, the slightest interruption brings out an attitude of anger, according to Jinshin Jutsu. Anger could take also the form, it can be sometimes disguised, it can be disguised as spacing out. And it can be disguised as boredom. So different forms of turning away. So then the practice when we notice that there's anger is that there's a lot of interest. Because it might not be so wrong. What is that one little, technical word in spirituality would be like discriminating thought, which is very interesting in terms of nonviolent communication and social action and different forms of discrimination. But discriminating thought by the one who's supposed to be fighting discrimination. Who's pressuring myself to put an end to discrimination. And then the pressure discriminates. And that pressure stops the flow, even the slightest. So it's really practicing getting out of the way and letting the flow, and sometimes it is uncomfortable. But starting to be very sensitive to the discriminating thought that comes. They'll come. And in a way, in Jinshin they talk about, it's considered actually a protective mechanism that there would be an interruption in the flow when we are not allowing, when we're indulging in an attitude like anger. It's called a safety energy lock, which is a really weird and cumbersome name. the way in Jin Shinjutsu they consider us to be made is that we have these places that are kind of like fuses in an electrical system, that if there's overload, in Jin Shin also we considered if there's underload, either way, then that place will lock as safety for the rest of the system. So that would be kind of like of the with the 60,000 sons, the 60,000 children, if one of them was like running for the lamps, or running to go redecorate the parents' home, or running to go get the horse, or whatever they were running for, and like shouting out, "I'm gonna look at this great design I have for mom and dad's house, or mom and mom's, or dad and dad's, or whoever's house it is." that misalignment that's there, the assumption that's been taken for granted, the discriminating thought of me and them, or me and my project, the occupation, would then just, that sun would just suddenly lie down and rest and not be able to tell everybody else and pass the idea on. Wouldn't that be great if that happened in any way? And then the fact that that one guy, for some reason I'm sticking with the boys, I don't know why, is lying down, that could call our attention, like, oh, what's happening? Why are you resting when everybody else is running around shouting? Do you need help? Which is the main thing. The possibility of an answer, a response, do you need help? Maybe not in words, not everyone would take it so well, but is there some help needed here? So with Jin Shin and new energy coming in, and how easily that can go to anger. So even with someone like Kapil, before he could even think about it. But there was the sense of disturbance of the meditation. I don't even think it was conceptualized. I have the feeling that it was just the fact that the meditation was such a claustrophobic meditation. So much contained and for himself, instead of going that much more inward, that it spreads out. And so there was a disturbance of the meditation, but then we could say that the meditation was a disturbance of the wholeness already. So that's where we could start to feel how that part of the story could go differently. But it's also interesting that in Jin Shinjutsu, the eyes are connected to the same flavor of energy, which is called qi in this case. New life energy coming in, so the sense of newness, like springtime. And this, it's all so relevant to the nonviolence. When the freshness is there, it's full of vitality, and it's also so vulnerable. And that it's another indication of how just the slightest word, or the slightest going along with my preference, or the slightest sense of me and them, the slightest defensiveness even, however understandable, because there's been so much pain, etc. But how, in that situation where the plant has just sprouted, the slightest word or defense could kill it. Does. And yet, it still needs to be in, you know, so it still needs the rain and the sun and the earth and some CO2. And so I want to leave it that loose, that just suggestive, and we'll continue tomorrow more. Thank you for listening. May our practice and our lives be dedicated to the liberation of all.